Support for NPR comes from ADP. Say you're in HR and a solar flare adds an extra hour to each day. How would this impact business? ADP designs forward-thinking solutions to help your business take on the next anything. ADP, always designing for people.
Over 75 feature films premiered at the Sundance Film Festival this year. It was impossible to catch them all, but we did see a lot, and we're highlighting some of the standouts. They include a deeply personal coming-of-age story, a film starring Saoirse Ronan as a recovering alcoholic, and Steven Soderbergh's highly immersive Ghost Tale. I'm Aisha Harris, and today we're talking about some of the best things we saw at this year's Sundance Film Festival on Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR.
This message comes from NPR sponsor HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel. On The Sympathizer podcast, host Philip Nguyen joins the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen to discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts. This message comes from NPR sponsor BetterHelp. What's the right amount of socializing for you? Maybe you thrive around people, or maybe you need more alone time. Therapy can help you figure out your boundaries, how to recharge, and your social sweet spot, so you can build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. Try therapy with BetterHelp. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Visit BetterHelp.com/NPR today to get 10% off your first month. This message comes from NPR sponsor CarMax. CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because CarMax believes you shouldn't just settle for a car, you should love your car. That's why every car they sell has CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. Don't settle. Find love at first drive. Start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Support for NPR comes from ADP. Say you own a business, then suddenly a solar flare adds an extra hour to each day. Would you add an extra shift, shift office hours, install those weird sleeping pod things? You can try to figure it out on your own, or just get ADP. From HR to payroll, ADP designs forward-thinking solutions to help your business take on the next anything. Even unexplainable cosmic events that end up granting humanity an extra hour a day. ADP, always designing for people.
Joining me today is Culture Desk correspondent Mandalit Del Barco. Welcome back, Mandalit.
Thank you so much.
It's great to have you. Also joining us is the host of NPR's It's Been a Minute, Brittany Luce. Welcome back to you too, Brittany.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Yes, yes. So Brittany, Mandalit, and I all went out to Park City, Utah to cover the Sundance Film Festival, which celebrated its 40th anniversary this year. Wow, 40 years. That's kind of crazy. We figured we'd highlight some of the films worth keeping on your radar as they hopefully get wider release in the coming months. So let's get right into it. Mandalit, what is your first pick?
My first pick is Dee Dee. It's a semi-autobiographical film by writer-director Sean Wong, and he's had an incredibly insane week at Sundance. Just days after premiering Dee Dee, he found out he was nominated for an Oscar for his short documentary Nai Nai and Wai Po, which stars his two grandmothers. And Dee Dee is his first feature-length film, and it's a story that includes one of those grandmothers, Nai Nai. This story follows a 13-year-old Taiwanese-American boy who lives in Fremont, California, just like Sean Wong, who shot the movie at his real-life childhood home. And in the movie, his character is known as Dee Dee to his family. That's an affectionate Mandarin term that means little brother or youngest son. And, you know, Aisha, he's like a lot of teens. He says cruel things to his mom and his sister. He's awkward with a girl from school who he likes. He does dumb things with his friends. And he pretends to be half white to impress the cool skater boys that he meets. And he offers to videotape them skateboarding. You know, the story is set in 2008. And on his desktop screen, which fills the movie screen, we see him writing things on MySpace and chats. You know, it's a lot of nostalgia for AOL messaging and Hotmail.
Yes, I really felt this deeply. I was a little older than he was in 2008, but I still vividly remember those AIM chats.
That's right. Yeah, there's some funny bits. We see him searching for things like how to kiss a girl and how to be a skate filmer. And, you know, these coming-of-age stories are really nothing new, especially at Sundance. But Wong told me he's never before seen a movie about a 13-year-old Asian-American kid like him.
That was the hope, was to hopefully add something unique to that canon of coming-of-age movies, inspired by my own upbringing, but it's not one-to-one with my own upbringing. Ultimately, our story is, you know, exploring themes of shame and love and friendship and belonging.
Yeah, it touched me deeply. And like you said, we've seen many of these coming-of-age stories, especially at Sundance, but I don't know, there's just something very specific about this rendering. Even the way that the teenage boys talk to each other, you know, using sort of homophobic language, it feels very of that era.
Right.
And I think that's what makes this rise above, and also just the performances, especially by Isaac Wong. Brittany, did you have a chance to check this out?
I didn't have a chance to check it out. I really wanted to, but I made friends in line, and they had both just come from a morning DD screening, and they were just absolutely head over heels in love with the film. That's one I'm really, really excited to see, hopefully, when it gets some sort of distribution and I can see it in a theater.
Yeah, well, we will see. Hopefully, it does get distribution. And that is DD, directed by Sean Wong. Now, Brittany, tell me what your first pick is.
Oh, my first pick is called The Outrun. It's directed by Nora Fingscheid and written for the screen by Nora Fingscheid and Amy Liptrot. It stars, of course, Saoirse Ronan as this character, Rona, who after basically her life has kind of fallen apart because of her drinking, she moves back home to like the Scottish countryside and these islands called the Orkney Islands, where she grew up. And she is basically trying to heal from kind of the mess that her life has become. It's adapted by a memoir, actually, by Amy Liptrot. But the film is something that absolutely stands on its own. This was one where, like, I had mentioned just now that I made some friends in line when I was waiting for this movie, The Outrun. And we end up sitting together during the screening. And I was trying to, like, not make them feel like they had to be emotionally responsible for me because I had tears coming down my face. So I was like discreetly wiping my eyes. This is not an easy watch, I'll say.
No.
But it does have like this joyous emotional payoff in the way that you see Rona just deal with the everyday treachery and drudgery of maintaining sobriety. Yeah. There are gorgeous performances from all of the supporting actors involved, but I specifically want to shout out Papa Esiadu, who is a phenomenal actor who a lot of people may remember from I May Destroy You on HBO. Also, he was in a really fantastic, like, longer episode of Black Mirror, where he played sort of like disco dancing demon.
He's got range.
He's got range. He plays her partner in this film. And even though he's, I think, in some ways underused, I mean, their relationship was so beautifully realized. And the movie was really beautiful. It was an incredible experience to have in the theater. There's like some beautiful sound design and some great visuals of just like the sea, nature. I feel like it sounds corny the way I'm describing it, but the payoff in the theater was just gorgeous. And I'm really excited. I feel like this one's definitely going to get distribution. And I would say that like, if and when it makes it into theaters near you later this year, just definitely make sure you see it. It's really beautiful.
Yeah, this is for me, a standout performance from Saoirse Ronan. It's heavy, though. Like you said, it is very heavy. And it was a movie where, like, I was supposed to see another movie afterwards. And then I was like, I can't do this. I need to go home and sleep. It was like, it's too much. It's far too much. That is The Outrun. And I'm going to turn to my first pick now, which is a ghost tale from Steven Soderbergh. This movie is called Presence. And it's a collaboration with screenwriter David Koepp. This movie is one of those, like, what the just happened here experiences. And one of those experiences that I've had for the first time in a very long time. So the less you know going into this, the better. But the basic crux of it is you have a family that moves into a house. And that family is made up of Lucy Liu, Chris Sullivan, and then the children are played by Kalina Liang and Eddie Mayday. And they move into this house, but the entire film from beginning to end is told from the point of view of a ghost that lives in the house. And so you are first person. The camera is following this family. It is privy to all of these deep conversations and emotional moments, and not just in adolescent life, but in parental life. And the technical feats here are kind of ridiculous. You know, Steven Soderbergh basically is that extra character. He is telling the story from that point of view. And I'm sure that this is going to be studied in film classes for years to come. But for me, what really elevates this is that this is a story that is kind of told in sequences. Like, just you have these moments that are just kind of little plays in a way and little scenes. Mm. And it's probably one of his more intimate and sort of very personal film. It's also very twisty. And the twist I'm still chewing over, Mandalay, you saw this, right? Like,
oh, yeah. Wait, you know, my friends and I, we had long discussion about who's the ghost.
Yes.
Who's the ghost?
Right. So we won't get into it, but like, as you're watching it, you do kind of wonder, like, who is this person? Who are mm-hmm. we supposed to be seeing through? So it was sold to Neon, and so it should be hopefully making its way, I hope, to theaters at some point, because this really does feel like the type of movie you want to watch completely in the dark in a theater. That is Presence, directed by Steven Soderbergh, hopefully coming to a theater near you. Now, Mandalay, I want to turn to your next pick, which was also one that I really, really loved. Tell us about it.
Yeah, that's Exhibiting Forgiveness. And this film was written, directed, and produced by the artist Titus Kaphar. He's a MacArthur Fellow, and he's known for his paintings and sculptures and installations. And his debut film is this really raw, powerful story about an artist who's forced to reconnect with his father, who was very abusive. He wrote the story based on his own real-life relationship. And, you know, this movie is about generational trauma and healing, and it has some really amazing performances by Andre Holland, who you may remember from his very touching role in the movie Moonlight. Mm-hmm. And he also has portrayed civil rights leader Andrew Young in Selma. But in this movie, he plays the main character, an artist who has nightmares about his childhood. And, you know, for this role, Kaphar taught him how to paint. And there are close-ups of his brush strokes. And mm-hmm. you could see and almost feel the texture on the canvas. And you can see the rage in his face and his body and his performance. And it seems like a very realistic portrayal of an artist at work. In the movie, Terrell's wife is a singer, played by Andra Day. The movie also shows her process of creating art, and she composes and sings for her mother-in-law. Her mother-in-law is played by Anjanue Ellis-Taylor,
who is only a decade older than Andre Holland, but we'll let it go.
I was like, are y'all siblings? Like, what's going on?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, she was great in the role, but I
oh, had she to, was phenomenal. They both
I had to Google. I was like, wait. I didn't realize they were okay.
Yeah, right, right. Yeah. And his dad is played by John Earl Jelks. Mm-hmm, he's first seen as an addict living on the streets, and there are flashbacks of his cruelty, you know, and we watch him change and trying to change into a better man. You know, Kaphar noted that Jelks was a theater actor who, back in the day, August Wilson used to use him in many of his works.
Jelks really blew me away. Like, I was so, so immersed in that performance. I think this is a movie that for the first, like, 20 minutes or so, I was like, this feels like a lot of, you know, indie melodramas. And then at one point, it just kind of opens up and unfolds and is really wrestling with some fascinating issues when it comes to forgiveness and generational trauma in a way that, like, I kept wondering, is it going to, you know, fold? Is it going to fold? Because so often I see movies that are also not afraid to sort of mention religion and how that factors into it. But they always end in a way that I'm just like, I don't know about this.
What do you mean you say that? Like, what do you mean when you say that? Because I mean, I feel sometimes dissatisfied the way that some of those films end. But I want to know what you mean when you say that.
Well, that's what I mean. And I don't want to give too much. I don't want to give too much away. Yeah. But I think that the answers here are not easy in the way that often I see them, especially when it comes to Black dramas that are dealing with forgiveness. I'm looking at you, you know, the Tyler Perrys of the world. It's like, I don't think it's not so black and white the way it ends. And I appreciated that. And I also just definitely got those August Wilson vibes for sure. It reminded me of something like Fences, right?
Yes. Yes. Or like The Piano Lesson or something like that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It was very like a play, but better than a play almost, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. It's still very cinematic. In my
yes. Mind. It's still very cinematic, especially in that, like, it made use of so many different types of visuals, but like mm-hmm. it made use of the fact that it was being shot as a film. Some really interesting uses of like what at first feel like visual pastiche to sort of show the main characters like childhood memories that yeah. then become clearer and clearer over the course of the film, till even just the way that like some of the interiors are lit. I don't know. There's like a real painterly aspect to the way that some of the visuals and the colors were used in the film that I was like, oh, it was interesting to see a painter working in this new medium in this way.
Absolutely. Well, that is Exhibiting Forgiveness. And as of right now, when we're recording this, we don't know if it's going to have distribution anytime soon, but hopefully people will be able to check it out at some point. Now, Brittany, your next pick is familiar subject matter to perhaps a lot of people.
Yes, my second pick is the documentary Luther, Never Too Much, directed by Don Porter.
Yes.
Now, I will say, for big Luther heads like myself, okay, mm-hmm. there's not necessarily new information in the documentary. When I say big Luther heads, I mean like, you know, may have read a biography or two, like over 300 pages about his life story. So, like, I mean, there's a lot yes. of things that I really, really know about Luther Vandross. So I didn't necessarily learn anything new, I'll say, from watching this documentary. But so often there were so many nice snippets of rarer interviews with Luther that sometimes it felt like he was telling his own story mm-hmm. along with these incredible interjections from people like Jamie Foxx, who is one of the producers of the project, along with Colin Firth, which, like, good for you, Colin Firth, but also did Luther rock you that much? Like, I was just surprised always to see him as an EP on this project.
I think Luther rocked everybody, you know?
I mean, fair enough. But I mean, that's the other thing I'll say is that, like, you're seeing sometimes, whether it's the people who are closest to him, like a former assistant or like business associates, along with some of the biggest names of the music industry, like Mariah Carey, David Bowie, Jamie Foxx, all of these people who still have this deep reverence for his talent. And in some ways, I won't necessarily say to the movie's detriment, still feel very protective of yeah. his personal yeah. life. The one piece I think that really stuck out for me that I'm excited to see, like, and hear audience reaction to, is how difficult it was for Black artists to cross over yeah. in the 80s specifically. Like, this sort of like push-pull between like being thought of as sort of like too bougie for traditional R&B, but too Black for pop audiences, and how the music industry kind of stymied the efforts of Luther and artists like him for being able to reach, you know, wider audiences and maybe perhaps their fullest potential as like superstars. I think the other thing that it really gets at that is very much in still permeates the music industry currently is how we talk about celebrities and artists' bodies and their weight. Yeah. And also how we talk about their sexuality. In so many ways, the film is very sensitive to how much things have changed, but also the ways in which things still haven't.
Yeah, I think for me, I was so moved by it. But I think your point about it feeling like the conversations aren't quite as deep as we wanted to, this kind of felt like the Little Richard documentary from last year that also premiered at Sundance. Except in that documentary, you had a lot of not just talking heads who might have worked with him or were close to him,
yeah.
but you also had, you know, actual critics and academics yeah. who could kind of provide a context. And here with Luther, the only sort of talking head that I remember who was not sort of directly related to him in any way was the great music journalist Danielle Smith.
Danielle Smith, yeah.
And she's not used enough. And I feel like in the mode of this being a movie that's protective, even if we don't get the lurid details, not that I really want them, of yeah. his personal life, it would have been helpful to have like someone who has actually studied these things to add more context to the queer aspect of his life right. and the weight issues that he struggled with.
That's a really good point.
So that was something that I thought was missing. But nevertheless, by the end of this movie, I was a mess. I was a ball.
I know, and I was a mess, and I was like, let me pull up the Luther playlist.
Yeah, I was a ball of tears by the end of this. So that is Luther, Never Too Much, and hopefully we can look out for it at a later date. I think fans are going to be very satisfied. Mm-hmm. So my final pick is also a musical pick in a way, and it's also a documentary. It is Soundtrack to a Coup d'Etat, which is directed by Johan Grimompré. This movie is It's really, really hard to describe, but it is a sort of multimedia quilt that is discussing and examining the assassination of Congolese Prime Minister Patrice Lumumba. Now, you know, if you haven't taken a history class recently or it's not fresh in your mind, this movie is going to explain everything to you in 2.5 hours. There's a lot of things that are being thrown at you and a lot of information. But I think what makes this movie so great is the fact that it doles that information out in the most inventive and creative and artistic ways. Gris Mon Pre is basically taking jazz music of that era because, if you might recall, there was a period where in the late 50s and into the 60s where the United States was sending off jazz greats like Louis Armstrong and Nina Simone as like ambassadors, jazz ambassadors to the world. But they didn't realize this themselves, but they were basically being used as props to distract from all the collusion and political machinations that were leading to the overthrow, like basically a coup of the Congo for all of these nefarious, of course, capitalistic reasons. And he uses jazz, like clips of these performers in such, again, it's really hard to describe, but like jazz, it's just kind of, it feels improvisational, it feels free flowing, and yet it's all very, very specific. And I mean, I think one way it's been described is as like a video essay. And I think that's pretty accurate because oftentimes we're seeing quotes in interviews that are presented like footnotes on the screen. Text is coming up and at the bottom it has like the book and the page number, which it comes from. And it might seem didactic, but it's so useful. And it's also like showing the work, but doing it in a way that is really just keeps you engaged and keeps you on your toes. I was familiar with Patrice Lumumba and how the United Nations basically made his assassination happen. Mm-hmm. Like the United States and Belgium were fully in cahoots here. And some of the quotes coming from mercenaries and political bigwigs will just like leave you appalled. But then you have this music that is also there kind of propelling the entire narrative. And it's just, I really loved it. I think it's just really, really smart and taught me a lot and also just felt like a real cinematic sort of experiment in the best way possible. Did either of you get a chance to check this out?
No, I wanted to. I wanted to see this
one. No, but you sold me. This sounds great.
No, seriously. I mean, this is the way you described it is like, I was just interested in the story as it was, but the form thing that you've described, I'm like, make me even more excited.
Yeah, it's pretty fascinating. And I just, I hope as many people as possible see it. There's so many sort of cliches when it comes to documentary and ways to do it. And I think that this movie finds a way to bring a new sort of energy to just downloading a lot of information. There's a moment where with Nina Simone singing and you've got that propelling piano and it's just like, oh man, like this is cinema in the words. That's Soundtrack to a Coup d'etat. It's a documentary and very hopeful that people will be able to see it because it is something else. Well, we want to know what you think about this year's highlights from the Sundance Film Festival. Find us at facebook.com/BCHH. And that brings us to the end of our show. Mandalit, Brittany, thanks so much for being here. I loved all of your picks. And this was fun.
Yeah, that's
great. Thank you. This was so much fun. It was cool. This is my first ever Sundance. So I'm like, so glad that I got to come on here and talk about it with y'all.
Well, we also want to take a moment to thank our Pop Culture Happy Hour Plus subscribers. We appreciate you so much for showing your support of NPR. And if you haven't signed up yet, want to show your support and listen to the show without any sponsor breaks, that's a great deal. Head over to plus.npr.org/happyhour or visit the link in our show notes. This episode was produced by Liz Metzger and edited by Jessica Reedy and Mike Katziff. And Hello Come In provides our theme music. Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. I'm Aisha Harris, and we'll see you all tomorrow.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Mint Mobile. From the gas pump to the grocery store, inflation is everywhere. So Mint Mobile is offering premium wireless starting at just $15 a month. To get your new phone plan for just $15, go to mintmobile.com/switch. Support for NPR and the following message come from Rosetta Stone, the perfect app to achieve your language learning goals no matter how busy your schedule gets. It's designed to maximize study time with immersive 10-minute lessons and audio practice for your commute. Plus, tailor your learning plan for specific objectives like travel. Get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off and unlimited access to 25 language courses. Learn more at rosettastone.com/NPR.
Across America, history is often recorded on small markers. You've probably seen them on the sides of roads, in front of buildings, in the middle of nowhere. NPR's Laura Sullivan spent a year investigating thousands of markers and found a distorted version of America's history, but also curiosities, humor, and joy. Listen to the new episode of The Sunday Story on the Up First podcast from NPR.